For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, I wanted to start out today reading a verse from the Psalms. So we're going to read from Psalm 32, verse 9. And it says, "Do not be like the horse or the mule, who are without understanding, who have to be curbed with bit and bridle, or they will not stay near to you." And this is a verse that I wish I would have understood earlier on in my Christian life, but I don't know that I still understand it. It's about being so foolish that you won't come near to God unless you're pulled with a bit or a bridle. And I think for someone who struggles with being self-reliant and self-confident, that this is an especially true warning, something that really should get to us. I think that, you know, if we ever have the experience where, you know, when we're in a time of suffering, we're running to God and praying, but then as soon as things are fine, you know, we're not near Him. Or conversely, if we're in a time of great spiritual success and we're going to God and thanking Him and praying, and then when things quiet down, we're not near Him, we're like a horse that needs to be pulled with a bit or a bridle, or else we won't go near to Him. Certain things need to be there and be happening for us to be drawn into dependence on Him. And I'm like this. I definitely am like the person who knows that they have to get to the other side of this wall and just is bashing myself up against the wall, bashing my head, my body, taking a running leap. And then it's as though God is standing there saying, "Do you want to ask me how to get through this? Because I have the answer right here." And I'm like, why did I go through all that and have to learn the hard way? So what we're going to be talking about today is spiritual confidence. And this is something taught in the Bible that's very different and antithetical to what the world teaches us about confidence, what the world system teaches us. If you look at the moral of the story in any book or movie, cartoon even, it's believe in yourself, have a good self-esteem, trust yourself, like who you are. You have to love yourself and take care of yourself before you take care of others. And when we go to the Bible for instruction, we see those things are not taught. In fact, some of the opposite things are taught, right? In Philippians 3:3, it says, "I put no confidence in the flesh." It says the exact opposite of that. Romans 7:18, does someone want to read that for us? Do you guys have Bibles? No. Thank you. 7:18. Thank you.
"For I know that good itself does not dwell in me, that is in my sinful nature. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out."
Good. So yeah, as Christians, we're right to be suspicious of these sort of self-help claims about confidence. It doesn't match with what we read and learn in the Bible. And trying to emulate that thinking and trying to will ourselves into being confident people won't work. It doesn't work. So let's go ahead and figure out why. Because I think, you know, I think a lot of us will know that, but often we'll get confused about what the alternative is. So we're not supposed to be confident in ourselves or in our flesh, but what's the alternative? Is it weakness? Is it anemic, you know, sort of, I can't do anything? Because that's not really what we see in some of the characters in the Bible either. So let's try to figure this out. And let's look first at why self is not worthy of confidence. It has here in your notes, 1 Corinthians 4, verse 7. It says, oh, you guys didn't get your notes. Oh, no. See, we've been already going through some of these. Let's pass them. Pass them that way. Sorry about that. All right, so I'm just going to go ahead and read it for you then. It says, 1 Corinthians 4, verse 7, who regards you as superior? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as if you had not received it? And likewise, in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12 and 8, it says, we are not bold to class or compare ourselves with some who commend themselves. But when they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they are without understanding. For it is not he who commends himself that is approved, but he whom the Lord commends. So what we see from verses like these is that self is not worthy of confidence, and to try to build confidence in yourself, you have to rely on using unstable measurements. It's almost like the person who builds his house on the sand. It's, you know, I know that I'm good because I'm better than that person. And, you know, these things are all pretty unreliable, and these pep talks that we give ourselves are pretty hollow. And I think we start to feel that and feel that we wish that we had a more solid foundation for our confidence, which God does offer us. We can build our house on the rock and use measurements in our building that are fixed and are appropriate. But a lot of Christians I know are confused about humility. I think that sometimes we confuse guilt with humility, that if we feel really bad about ourselves and what we are and what we've done, that that is humble. A lot of times we confuse timidity or fearfulness, shrinking back, as humility, because, you know, we don't want to step out and do something that we really shouldn't be doing. But shrinking back is different than the biblical view of humility. A lot of times we view things like being strategic and effective or efficient as a lack of humility. We see that, you know, if people are talking about how to organize the church so that the most people can hear the message, or they're talking in that way and we're kind of bothered by that and feel that it's not humble, that might be a confusion about humility there. Likewise, we can view being really fiery or passionate or having disagreements as a lack of humility. And yet, if we are having these things, it's really hard to reconcile with some of the stories in the Bible, like the story of Jesus fashioning the whip and clearing out the temple. That doesn't seem too humble if we're considering humility in those terms. Jesus calling the Pharisees, you brood of vipers, and having this huge, passionate disagreement with them. Or Paul telling the people who are falsely teaching about circumcision, I wish you would just castrate yourself. That doesn't seem that humble either. Also, the people in the Bible were really excited about spiritual rewards and would talk about how, you know, I've done some great work, and I know that God's going to reward me for that, and that seems to go in the face of what we think as humility. So maybe humility is something different than we imagine. C.S. Lewis I had here. Well, before we get to that, no, let's just get to that. C.S. Lewis described humility as having a creaturely outlook. When he was troubled by the doctrine of heavenly rewards, he described this revelation that helped him understand humility, and here it is. He said, when I had thought it over, I saw that this view was scriptural. Nothing can eliminate from the parable and the divine accolade, well done, you good and faithful servant. With that, a good deal of what I had been thinking my whole life fell down like a house of cards. I suddenly remembered that no one can enter heaven except as a child, and nothing is so obvious in a child, not in a conceited child, but a good child, as its great and undisguised pleasure in being praised. Not only in a child either, but even a dog or a horse. Apparently, what I had mistaken for humility had, all these years, prevented me from understanding what is, in fact, the humblest, the most childlike, and the most creaturely of pleasures, nay, the specific pleasure of the inferior. The pleasure of a beast before men, a child before its father, a pupil before its teacher, a creature before its creator. That's from The Weight of Glory. G.K. Chesterton, also in his book Orthodoxy, talked about modesty and humility, and he said the great people, these great figures in the Bible, were unsure of themselves, but they were sure about the truth. And so the humility didn't rest in the organ of conviction, but it rested in the organ of ambition. And he said, nowadays, a lot of people have this completely reversed, where they will be sure of themselves and their own opinions, but unsure about the truth. And he's like, no, that's a backwards view of what humility is. And he has this, he's real funny. He has this real funny quote where he's like, we're going to produce a race of men who are too mentally modest to believe in the multiplication tables. You know, being unsure of the truth is not the humility that we see in the Bible. It's these people were sure of the truth. That's why Jesus was clearing out the temple. That's why Paul was saying, castrate yourself, is because they were concerned with the truth, confident about that, concerned about God's glory, and confident about that, but unsure of their selves and their own ambition, their ego. So, along these same lines is the teaching of boasting in the Lord, which is a funny and interesting teaching. I don't know that it's that easy to understand when it talks about boasting in the Lord, but we're going to read a few verses on this if people have Bibles. Galatians 6:14, you guys can write these down. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9, and then 2 Corinthians 10, verse 13 and 17. Can we get maybe three people to read those three?
I've got Galatians 6:14.
Thank you.
But may it never be that I would boast, except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, through which the world has been crucified through me, and I through the world.
And then 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9. Thanks.
12:9. But you said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses, so that Christ's power may rest upon me.
Thank you. And then 2 Corinthians 10, verse 13 and 17. Thank you. Just those two.
Right. 10:13.
But we will not boast beyond our measure, but within the measure of the sphere which God appointed to us as a measure to reach even as far as you. And 17. But he who boasts is to boast in the Lord.
Good. Let him who boasts boast in the Lord. This is a phrase that is repeated several times in the Bible. And in these three passages, we see that it talks about boasting in the Lord as a good thing. And yet, you know, to us and our culture, boasting is always bad. Nothing cools off a room faster than someone who's really boasting. Someone who comes in and says, like, I read a book every day. I run 10 miles every day, and it's, you know, ew. So that's why it's so weird that the Bible would recommend using this audacious tool as something that would be glorifying to God. But if you look carefully at what he says we should boast about, the first two verses say that we should boast in the cross and in our weaknesses. So I think what it's talking about there is that we should be boastful of how undeserving we are of God's favor and how God shows us favor in spite of ourselves. That's what he's describing there. The last one is the hardest to interpret because it's definitely seeming like he's talking about boasting about ministry. And we know that that seems uncool, right? So, but he says, I'm not going to boast beyond the sphere of my ministry, but within it I will boast. What could that mean? I think that it's just sharing joy about what God has given you to do, and sharing a joy that comes from ministry that is not based in ego, but that is based in, you know, the fact that God gives us opportunities and we are undeserving of those things. So yeah, let's go ahead and just look at one last verse here that has to do with humility and confidence. And this is from 2 Corinthians 3, 4 through 6. I think this really sums up these ideas well. It says, "Such confidence we have through Christ toward God, not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God, who made us adequate as servants of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life." So I think for those of us who may struggle more with self-confidence or being cocky and self-reliant, the phrase to really stand out to us is not that we are adequate in ourselves. And for those of us who may struggle more with shrinking back and timidity, we should focus on the phrase that says, "God, who has made us adequate as servants." So yes, it's definitely freeing. If you're someone who works hard and wants to achieve and wants to be out there doing and accomplishing and having ambition, to hear that you are not adequate in yourself is so relieving. I think it's really freeing. It can free us from trying to conjure up this grand identity for ourselves, right? And just realize the Bible and God are not interested in that conjuring that I'm trying to do. And I don't need to concern myself with that anymore. But for those of us who maybe feel, you know, I'm not that relational, I'm not that good with people, I'm not that dynamic, I'm not that whatever, fill in the blank, you know, to hear God has made you adequate as servants means God is able to do spiritually significant things through you. And we shouldn't discredit that with false humility. So here's the word that means spiritual confidence. And this is what this workshop is about. This is a word, parisia in the Greek. It's a biblical word that is always positive. And actually, in the Greek, there's a different word to describe arrogant self-confidence that's a negative concept, prideful confidence. And that word is tameo. But this word, parisia, when it is translated, it looks the same as the other word, but it actually, this one is always positive every time it's used. And it can be translated as confidence, boldness, assurance, freedom to speak, openness, honesty, fearlessness, courage, daring, freedom, liberty, joyfulness, delight, a special exercise of faith, unhesitating confidence of faith, a removal of fear and anxiety due to a removal of guilt. And some of the verses, you know, if you go from your Greek lexicon and see this word and look up where it's all used, you'll see that about half of them focus on belief and faith, and the other half focus on bravery or bold action. So here's just a couple examples. Hebrews 4, verse 16. "Let us draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." Ephesians 3:12, "Christ, in whom we have boldness and confident access through faith in him." And Ephesians 6:20, or I'm sorry, 2 Corinthians 3:12, I was about to skip one there. "Therefore, having such hope, we use great boldness in our speech," parisia, in our speech. Ephesians 6:20, "Pray that I may speak boldly as I ought to speak." So we can summarize the whole idea of parisia, spiritual confidence, by saying that spiritual confidence is an assured spiritual belief resulting in a bold spiritual action. And this is a concept that is always positive when it's used, but it's never commanded. It's not necessary to have a walk with God You know what I mean? And it's something that's a privilege that we can appreciate and enjoy. It's a blessing that we have access to, but it's not something that we need in order to walk with God. And I think, you know, for a lot of us who have been in ministry for a long time, we've probably felt this at certain times, felt this spiritual confidence, this bold action, and this bold, confident assurance of God's truths. But just like my dad's teaching last night in the end, if you were here for the second session in the night, he said, if you've been on this path where you understand God's part and our part, it's probably only for a little while, and then you're not on it again. So yeah, it's something that we get little tastes and glimpses of, but it's difficult to maintain for us, unfortunately. So what we're going to discuss for the rest of the class today is two different extremes that can rob us of spiritual confidence. And it's almost like if you think about a plateau with steep edges on either side, and if spiritual confidence was up here. There are two different ways that we can slip off this plateau, and we often do, either to one side or the other, or from one and then to the other. And one is super spirituality, which we'll talk about. And the other is human-centeredness, which was sort of talked about last night a little bit. But we'll talk about it again a little bit. And yes, so we'll talk about human-centeredness first. And human-centeredness is antithetical to spiritual confidence because it's only trusting in ourselves. It's self-confident. And also, it's sort of downplaying our assured spiritual belief because we're focused on viewing our own human resources and planning according to that. And then super spirituality, as we're going to see, sort of erodes the other side of that coin, the bold spiritual action, because it downplays the role of human agency. So we're going to look at that too. Let's talk about human-centeredness here first. Viewing things in light of the human resources and abilities available. You've heard the term, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. And when it comes to disciple-making specifically, or really any relationship, there are certain things we can do, but there are other things that we really can't do. And I know that I, in discipleship relationships in the past, have sort of led a horse to water that didn't want to drink and, you know, sort of stood there for a long time, splashing the water, being like, look, I'm drinking it, it's good, and, you know, trying to talk this horse into this. And then when they walk away without drinking, I'm like, what else should I have done? Maybe I should have got in that water and splashed it onto them and tried to get some in their mouth. What else can I be doing? This is a total picture of human-centeredness. This is in William R. Newell's commentary on Romans. He makes this great statement, to be disappointed in yourself means to have trusted in yourself. So yes, we have trusted in ourselves when we're having this type of ministry frustration. Yes, it's deep stuff. Worry and prayerlessness is another sign that we're being human-centered. And when I was growing up, I was raised in a Christian home. And any time that I would start like voicing some of my worries, like I'm worried about school tomorrow, whatever, my parents would just always be like, worry is a sin. And I'd be like, oh, I'm worried that this friend might be mad. Worry is a sin. And so I was sort of like had that drilled into my brain. And I don't think it's how most of us really think about worry. We don't think of anxiety as being a moral issue. But it does have real statements of command in the Bible, be anxious for nothing. You know what I mean? It does make that sort of emotion and our reaction to our obsession with it, a moral issue. So, yeah, I think, you know, to say the word sin, I don't know if I would say that to someone that I'm meeting with, but I would say this isn't God's will for you. You know what I mean? To live this way, to be anxious and be worried this way. Sin just means being askew of God's plan for us. You know what I mean? And this isn't part of what God desires for us, for his plan for us. Unbiblical expectations and responsibilities. Why wouldn't we worry if we were putting unbiblical expectations on ourselves, right? It just goes. It flows from one thing to another. If we are being unrealistic and unbiblical in our expectations and in the responsibilities that we're trying to take, of course we're going to have worry coming from that. And I had a quote I wanted to read for you guys that's really good. It's from a book on marriage, but I think it's really applicable to any relationship, a discipleship relationship, anything. It's from The Marriage Builder by Larry Crabb. And this quote is sweet. I wish that I would have read this marriage book earlier in my marriage. I've been married for 15 years right now, but I probably could have stopped some of my arguments earlier on if I understood this concept. He said, he's talking about the difference between goals and desires. He said, my objective may be that it rain this afternoon. But if I perceive my objective of rain as a goal, I'll try to set about some way to make that happen. But because I don't have the ability to control whether or not it rains, I'll only experience frustration and anger. And then he goes on to point out that if we view rain as a desire instead of a goal, we won't be trying to make it rain, but we can set a more appropriate goal, a goal that's within our own reach, within our own power, like, I want this lawn to be wet, in which case we can set about buying a sprinkler and doing that. We do have some power over that. But if we just are stuck on, I want it to rain, that's my goal, then it's not going to work out well for us. And then he concludes by stating, the proper response to a desire, then, is prayer. To a goal, the appropriate response is a set of responsible actions. If we confuse our goals and our desires, our responses will be wrong. Yes, they will, and they often are. Yes, I can't make it my goal to have my neighbor accept Christ. That's not an appropriate goal because it requires something that I have no power over, another person's free will. But I can say that's not an appropriate goal, it's a desire, and pray for that, and yet change and make a more appropriate goal and say, I want to share the gospel with my neighbor. That is appropriate. That's something I do have the power to do or not do. So that's the difference there. And burnout, which will happen if we have these unbiblical expectations and we're relying too much on ourselves, we're too human-centered. And one of my favorite passages about burnout is in 1 Kings 17 through 19, but there's others that are like it. But here it's talking about Elijah, and when he had sort of the best mountaintop, awesome victory and success spiritually in his whole life, which is that he had this confrontation with the prophets of Baal and basically proved to the whole nation, my God's better than your God, right? And sort of made this statement to people, and it was, you know, would have been awesome. It's something above and beyond what anyone in this room has ever accomplished, for sure. But even while he was depending on God for this great miracle, you can see, if you look closely and read in between the lines, he was also struggling some with an inappropriate view of himself, even while he was doing it. If you look in chapter 18, verse 22, I think it's 22, he makes this statement, I alone am the only prophet of the Lord that is left, and yet there are 450 prophets of Baal. And not only is this not true, but he knew it was not true, because right before this happened, he had run into Obadiah, who was a prophet of the Lord, and Obadiah had said to him, hey, there's a whole bunch of prophets, a whole group of them that are living in these caves. So he knew he's not the only one. But you can see that, you know, sort of when you're in this pressure cooker, you can begin to feel like I'm the only one who's doing anything, right? And it will result in burnout, which is what happens with Elijah in the next chapter, in chapter 19. He's completely depressed, completely burnt out. He just keeps repeating, I'm the only one who cares. I'm the only one who's doing anything. And God sort of like attends to his need for rest and food first. But then when he confronts this, he's like, actually, I have 7,000 people here in this area that are following me. And actually, what you need to do is go and delegate. And he gives these list of people who Elijah needs to delegate into leadership so that he's sort of experiencing this multiplication process that we've been talking about all week. And he even talks about Elijah's replacement, Elisha, and says, you need to go meet with this person, mentor them, and delegate some of your work to them. So that was kind of the answer there to the burnout that he was feeling. A magical view of religious acts, where we have a transactional relationship with God, where we're experiencing feelings like, if I want my teaching to be good, I better pray for 20 minutes. If I, you know, have a failure, maybe it's because I forgot to blank. And we're thinking of God in terms of a transaction, and that is because we depend on ourselves. You know what I mean? That's because we're like, I know I have an important part to play for certain things to happen here. It goes back to self-confidence. And it can sort of be summed up, self-confidence, man-centeredness, as being not a branch. If you look at the Lord's Prayer, Jesus says, pray this, the Lord's will be done. But a lot of times what we are praying for when we wake up in the morning is, okay, God, here's my will. Here's my plan for today. I think this should happen. It'd be sweet if that girl did this. Be sweet if I could say this to that person. And we're saying, bless my will be done. And we're not really even asking, what is your will here? And it always predisposes us to further worry and further sin when we have this type of approach to the Christian life. So here's a quote here from We Would See Jesus, Roy and Revel Hessian. I'm not even sure how to say that. He says, it's possible for any of us at any time to assume the position, often unconsciously, of the vine. And he's talking here, of course, about John 15, the vine and the branches. And he says, rather than being a branch attached to the vine, we want to be the vine. We start the day as if it was our day. We make our plans for our day and fully intend to do our best for the Lord. But the very responsibility of trying to be the vine makes us tense. And this tenseness always predisposes us to further sin. God is the vine to me only as I repent of trying to be the vine myself. We would be much happier living like a branch, much happier. So, but let's talk about this other side then here, super spirituality. This is a phrase. If you've never heard this term before, it's a phrase that was coined by Francis Schaeffer in his book, The New Super Spirituality. And he was using it in a sarcastic way, like in a joking way. He was saying not that someone is awesome and so spiritual and super spiritual, but that someone is sort of downplaying the fact that they have anything to do with spiritual things and saying, it's kind of a let go, let God. If God wants something done, he'll get it done. You know what I mean? I'm so spiritual, I would never depend on myself. And he's saying this is actually ignoring a huge portion of teaching in the Bible about human agency and about our own responsibilities. So if we struggle and slip off here and struggle with this, we may use grace defensively, grace as a shield, to protect us from certain convictions. And this was mentioned last night when he said that certain people will think about Christian work or doing any work as, you know, being legalistic, saying that's so legalistic. And that's sort of using grace defensively to protect yourself from some of those convictions and some of those calls to act that are there in the Bible. Another sign that we may be into super spirituality is what's called spiritual gluttony. And this term comes from a chapter in Seeking the Face of God, which is a great book, and he discusses how we look at spirituality as an experience for me. You know what I mean? And it's all about gorging ourselves on spiritual intake, but it not having anywhere to go out. So it's just coming in and not going out into action and into being a blessing to others. Uncomfortable doctrines, which I think is the best way for me to see when I'm becoming super spirituality, is certain doctrines will bother me for some reason. And one of them is right here, the doctrine of spiritual rewards, just like what C.S. Lewis was struggling with. And when he gave that description of humility, right before that he said, spiritual rewards is not a doctrine that's fashionable. You know what I mean? That doesn't seem cool. That's not fashionable. And I think it's because the idea of being rewarded is like, you know, the idea of doing something good and getting a pat on the head. And I think that when that bothers us, it's not because of humility that it bothers us, but it's because we either don't want to do the good things or we don't want to get the pat on the head. So, this is a doctrine, though, that will prick at our pride if we're feeling super spiritual, because it has to do with human agency and with our actions being something that matter. Human agency, we already discussed that. Organization in the church, this is something that's not fashionable either, because when someone's making like a chart or a graph or a plan or trying to organize things in a certain way, that seems, you know, not cool, not humble, not spiritual. And yet, if you look at passages like 1 Corinthians 14, it sort of lays out, you know, have your meeting be in an orderly way. And it ends by saying, our God is not a God of confusion, but a God of peace. So he doesn't want a meeting that's full of confusion. He does want things to be somewhat organized, and we do have a role to play in that. Focused on restrictions rather than on action. Getting pride or ego from certain things that we've given up, certain things that we've denied ourselves, rather than thinking about what things we go out and do. And I think a lot of times we can catch ourselves going into this mindset where we can say something like, well, I really want to blank, so God must want opposite blank, right? We definitely feel that. I was talking to my brother when, this was like 9 years ago, when I was pregnant with my second kid, and the first son that I had was male, and the second time I was pregnant, I was like, I really hope it's a girl. You know, because we were only planning on having two kids. And I was like, I have a boy, I really hope it's a girl. And Joe, my brother, I didn't mean to say his name. I was just going to say my brother. But yeah, Joe, I said it. He said, well, you shouldn't have said that, because now that you said you want a girl, God's definitely going to give you a boy. You know what I mean? And he sort of had this little argument with me, like, you know, first of all, it shouldn't be important what the sex of the baby is, and it's not. But he's like, the fact that you made it important and that you said you wanted God to give you a girl, he's not going to reward that kind of attitude. And I think that this goes from a focus really on what God is as a restrictor versus as a giver with a mission and things like that. I did end up having a girl, so I was like, he was like, I hate you, but yeah. I think, you know, I don't think those attitudes are always wrong. I think sometimes God is trying to challenge things in us, but I think that we shouldn't automatically trust those assumptions about what God wants and how it must be so different than what we want. We should question those assumptions and see if there's any basis in it or if it's something in us, something in our own perhaps super spiritual framework that's creating those expectations on God that really aren't consistent with reality. Being worried about motives, this is a big one. And I did have a guy in one of my home groups, this is, you know, back 12, 13 years ago or something, but he was a great evangelist. He brought all kinds of people around. I remember him explaining to me, I think I've started to take too much ego from being the person who brings all these people around. And I think what I need to do is take a little break from bringing these people around to sort of like reassess me and God and see where we are. And then, you know, I'll come back to it once I can sort of have my motives more purified. And, you know, I can't look into someone else's soul and their relationship with God and know if God really is calling him to this. But I can say anecdotally, you know, looking at his example and what happened is that he sort of withdrew from people and then self-destructed. It didn't appear to be that good of an idea. And there are passages in Scripture, even at the end of the list of the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians, it's talking about the fruit of the Spirit is love, it's patience, it's these things, and it says, against such things, there is no law. In other words, it's never wrong to do these things, whether we have good or bad motives. It's always good to do those things. Paul likewise said, I don't like to examine my own motives in 1 Corinthians 4. I'll let God worry about that. And he says in another passage in Philippians, these people are preaching Christ out of bad motives, but I don't care, just as long as the message of Christ is getting out there. Who cares if their motive is good or bad? Sometimes the actions are more important than our heart attitudes. Because God can kind of bypass us and it can be about someone else and not necessarily about us. At other times, he'll probably stop us and work on our motives, but we can leave that up to him and let him deal with our motives when he's ready to deal with them. Against such things, there is no law. And finally, my last point here before we can open it up for discussion is having sort of these presumptuous, let go, let God kind of attitude. And I think if you go back to the example about wanting it to rain, the example there about goals and desires, and look at it on the other side, you know, let's say we realize I can't make it rain, I shouldn't make that a goal, but then we take it further and say, if God wants the lawn to be wet, he will get it wet and there's nothing I can do about it. You know what I mean? There's another misunderstanding on that side where we're, you know, he said the proper response to a desire is prayer, but the proper response to an appropriate goal is a set of responsible actions. So there are actions and our actions can and do matter. So finally, you know, the cure then to this problem, if we are in here, is more understanding about God's providence, understanding he has a will, he is doing, he is acting, and I can get in line with that, and that will help bring us back up. And the answer here is more understanding on human agency. And that is all I have for today, but I thought we could open it up. Let's see, I think, yeah, we have 15 minutes, so we can have some discussions and questions and then some time of prayer. So if anyone has any comments or questions, we can talk about those or experiences that you've had. Is everyone here perfectly balanced in their view? Yeah.
I remember some years ago I was volunteering as a prayer partner at the Free Clinic. And I began to question my motives about
Mm-hmm.
Because often when people have the opportunity to pray, they were so grateful to have their needs articulated and be able to have someone lift them before the Lord. And I began to think I was just getting a lot of warm fuzzies, and that was my whole reason for doing it.
Yeah.
So I, you know, wrote to Bruce Robinson, who was the head of the clinic,
mm-hmm.
and I'm withdrawing. I take my name off the list. I'm, you know, taking a break. I don't need to do this. And Bruce was just, what are you doing? And anyway, I shared what I was going to do with a couple of the sisters of my home group,
mm-hmm.
and they called a meeting with me
mm-hmm.
and said, look, if we, you know, waited for our rights, you know, mm-hmm. to be perfectly perfect before we did anything, we wouldn't do anything before the Lord.
So true, yeah.
And then, to top it all off, Mary had a teaching in which, after which somebody raised their hands and said, if my motives aren't good, should I,
mm-hmm.
and Mary said, forget about it,
yeah.
you know, in a nutshell.
Yeah.
And I then contacted Bruce Robinson and said, forget I ever said anything.
You know, yeah.
I'm back.
That's good. Another thing, too, that I had meant to mention but didn't, I think I somehow skipped it, was under human agency, a thing that we can experience is provincialism, where we're only focused in on a very small, a very small ministry because we're concerned about how much we have to offer, and it shrinks our world down. And I definitely had an experience of this where at that time I was working in a college ministry. So I was just like tunnel vision, could only see people that were that age at that time. And I was sitting, studying my Bible of all things in this restaurant. And this woman who was probably about 50 was crying behind me. But I just was, you know, doing my study and didn't do anything at first. But then she just kept crying and crying. And I mean, literally, I think, cried for half an hour. Eventually, it started like pulling at my heart, and I'm like, what can I do for this woman? I don't even have a church to bring her to if I did talk to her, because she wouldn't come to this 18-year-old thing that I have. But I just went over and talked to her and was able to share the gospel with her and invite her to this other church. And I mean, she just was hugging me, was treating me like I was an angel sent from God. And I thought, it just was a spear through my heart. I thought, how selfish and close-minded and provincial was I for so long, sitting here for 20 minutes while she cries and ignoring her. If I had headphones, I probably would have put headphones on and sat there reading my Bible and not even doing anything that looks like what it says to do. You know what I mean? So it was a huge wake-up call to how we can sort of get blinders and get, you know, get too focused and too restricted in what we think we can do. Yeah. 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 Absolutely, yeah. 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 Absolutely. And I think this is sort of advanced and challenging stuff, because I think whether we're here or both, we often have a good heart for the Lord and do want to serve him and please him. And yet, you know what I mean, there's struggles there that do take us away from sort of the picture that's laid out. And I had one really important thing to say and I forgot it now. Never mind, it might come back to me. Who else has one? Yeah. Okay.
When you're talking about this in the motives of, do it anyway,
mm-hmm.
is that a same response to give?
To give to someone who's struggling with whether they should accept Christ or not?
Or even if they have accepted, thinking like, do I accept, are my motives bad in accepting
them? That's a good question. What do you guys think? Yeah.
I think God is really eager to save people. Like, I doubt the guy on the cross next to Jesus was like, perfect motives, understood the gospel fully and all the aspects.
That's good.
He was just like, can I be in your kingdom? Like, absolutely.
Yeah.
Come in.
And he didn't have any chance to do anything that good or to have some great attitude be developed. That's good. Good. Which one?
The rich
one.
The
one who
Jesus says it's easier for
to go through that camel to go through an eye of a needle than to enter the kingdom of heaven. I think, it is a narrow road. And I think perhaps that some people who have maybe said the words or said, I am a Christian, and yet have no faith experience with God, may not really have salvation in the sense that God says, Jesus also says, some will come and say, Lord, Lord, and I'll say, I never knew you, and it was just some external act that didn't have anything to do with a cleansing, forgiveness, interaction of relationship with Christ. But if that happens, I think someone can be definitely assured that they're good, so. I think when he describes like the narrow road of salvation, or it's harder, that he's it's a description. It's not like he's prescribing and saying to us, not many people you talk to are going to whatever, but he's saying there's a lot of people who aren't going to ask me for this. It's more descriptive. Yeah.
Don't you think it's talking more about
Yeah.
Because they're rich, they're confident in the physical world instead of the spiritual world.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And in other places he says, it's narrow the road that leads to salvation. Yeah.
What is the human agency part of God's providence? Like, how do we grow in that?
Well, I think, understanding and depending less on ourselves and more on God's actions and God's will, that's, sort of the cure for human-centeredness. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Like how this arrow is related to this?
Yeah, but I guess, are there human actions that move us along the arrow?
That's hard. I don't know. For me, I definitely studied this stuff. I studied God's providence and God's part and man part, all that stuff. Studying helps, but it's not going to necessarily change your heart. But it's almost like when you're a kid and you're taking French in school and you hate it and you're just doing these exercises and it doesn't mean anything to you. And later on, maybe you grow to love French. Those actions of sort of like putting the information in and letting God do what he will with it later on, that is one part that we can do, is just seek to put that information in and let see what God will do with it. So, good. Well, let's go ahead and pray. We have 5 minutes here. If a couple people want to say a prayer for us, that would be great.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.